From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The new Cold War is being accompanied by a propaganda war. One of its targets, the head of official U.S. government propaganda. The U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors is an independent agency of the U.S. government. According to its website, the board's mission is to, quote, inform, engage, and connect people around the world in support of freedom and democracy, closed quote. In other words, it is the official voice of U.S. propaganda. This past July, the BBG's chair, Jeffrey Schell, was denied entry to the Russian Federation upon his arrival at a Moscow airport. Russia's foreign ministry said in a statement, quote, Schell has been recently put on the blacklist, expanded by Moscow in response to visa restrictions against Russian citizens imposed by Washington under far-fetched pretext, closed quote. The statement added, quote, the person in question stands at the head of a broadcasting board, a government agency that governs the operations of U.S. propagandist radio stations like the Voice of America and Radio Liberty, closed quote. The following exchange took place after the announcement of Schell being denied entry to the Russian Federation at a July State Department press briefing between State Department spokesperson Mark Toner and Associated Press reporter Matt Lee.
What is your understanding of what happened to the head, the Broadcasting Board of Governors chairman? Have you made representations to the Russians? Will this come up when the secretary is there tomorrow? Tomorrow or Friday?
So a couple of things on that, Matt. First of all, we're still, frankly, in the process of sorting through all the details of what happened yesterday or last night on the timing of what occurred. But obviously, everybody's seen the reports. You know also that the Broadcasting Board of Governors did issue a statement on the matter. I'd refer you to that and to them for additional details. I'm limited here, and I'm limited because we've not yet received a Privacy Act waiver. Once I do, I'll be able to say a bit more, but not a whole lot more about the incident and about the case. I said a little bit.
So Privacy Act now applies to official government, you know, all right, it's an independent government agency, and I realize that it is kind of a part-time, it is a part-time job, but he still was traveling in his official capacity. The BBG, as you noted, put out a statement. It said that the other people who were with him on this delegation went to the embassy, spoke to Ambassador Teft, and then they thanked Ambassador Teft and the department back here for their
So I was going to
urgent,
finish that. Right. Allow me to go on a little bit further. That's okay. No worries. We were, when alerted our embassy in Moscow to the what was happening and to the incident, we did obviously go and assist Chairman Schell, but your question highlights some of the ongoing questions and details that we're trying to sort through, which is in exactly what capacity he was traveling. And I have to stop there because you said it is a role that he plays. He's also a private citizen.
That he was supposed to go to a reception or to ceremony today, marking an anniversary for Radio Liberty in Moscow. That would seem to me that he was doing this not in his private capacity at NBC Universal, but rather in his capacity as chairman of the BBG.
Again, I don't want to read too much into this, and I don't want to. All I'm trying to say, Matt, is I don't have full Privacy Act clearance to go any further. And frankly, we're still trying to sort through the details of what actually happened as to why he was denied. That's really something for the Russians to speak to. Whether we raised our concerns with the Russians, we did.
You did.
Whether it will come up and with Secretary Kerry, I don't know.
The Russians have said that the reason that he was denied entry was because he was put on an expanded stop list that was expanded because you guys expanded sanctions against individual Russians. Have they not given you that explanation? They made it publicly.
Have they made that publicly? Well, look, Matt, I'm not going to, again, they've said publicly, they've offered their explanation. I said it's not for us to explain what happened to him. It's for them to speak to why they refused his entry.
For more on that, we spoke with Peter Laveau, who hosts RT's Crosstalk, produced in Moscow, is a U.S. citizen, born and raised in the United States, and now living in Moscow. We spoke with him via Skype Sunday. Peter, welcome back. A pleasure to have you, as always.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Don.
So you're in Moscow looking at what's going on in the United States from that vantage point. What's it look like with this new Cold War and McCarthyism and all of the stuff they're saying about the country in which you live?
You know, it's very interesting because the strategy of the American political establishment and its minions, particularly in Europe and the Washington consensus, as we can call it, it's really remarkable for educated Russians watching it all unfold, because I think I've said on your program before that, you know, when you look at the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Economist, Financial Times, all of them, they're instantly translated into Russian. People, educated Russians, have a greater awareness of what's going on in the outside world than most Westerners do, because of the closed media that the West has. And if these people in the establishment were hoping to instigate some kind of colored revolution, some kind of revolt in Moscow against the legal and constitutional authority of Russia, they have failed absolutely miserably. You know, to add insult to injury, it was the Olympics, interestingly enough, that people that are not politically driven or interested, I mean, the Russians are like most people in the world, they're interested in their standing of a standard of living. Right. But when the Olympic tragedy and scam against Russian athletes happened and was unfolding, I'll tell you, the getting people lined up behind the political class here, the political establishment, they didn't have to do it. All they had to do was literally translate what was being said about their athletes. That was a slam dunk. Slam dunk. I mean,
I could imagine
it didn't have to say anything about that.
I could imagine, for example, let's say that the Super Bowl was actually a true international event, and somebody said that the Americans can't participate because they're bad people and they did drugs and stuff.
Exactly. And the thing is that from Russians that are interested in such things, they don't understand how they see the West as being so unreasonable, and they say that the West says it should be a level playing field and there should be the rule of law. And from this side of the equation is that it's all done arbitrarily. The double standards are glaring, and this is something that Russians find galling. Remarkably so. And when people ask me about how the sanctions are working, more and more Russians now are actually saying the sanctions are good for us because we've had import substitution. We can go without them. We don't need them. And the allure of the West is diminished remarkably since the Ukraine crisis started, where I keep telling my Russian friends, you don't be fooled by the trinkets and the dazzle and the sparkle of the West, because they're no friend of you, no friend at all. And this is becoming more and more apparent. I also want to make sure that your listeners understand is that Russia is a war adverse country to the core. Mm. The losses during the Second World War were so overwhelming that it is imprinted on the genetic code of the average Russian. You cannot walk down any town or big city in Russia and you don't see monuments to the Great Patriotic War, the Second World War. They have been bled so badly in history, that's the last thing they want. And so when they read this propaganda, again, literally just translate it into Russian, they don't even have to have an explanation or a commentary. Just listen to what these people are saying. Listen to what Mr. Morrell, the former acting director of the CIA, on Charlie Rose. Just translate it into Russian, and they'll understand what's going on. They mean to illegally murder us around the world. Another slam dunk. The Kremlin doesn't even have to have its own propaganda. All it has to do is to translate it into Russian.
So that's the impact, or really negative impact, of U.S. propaganda against Russia in front of a Russian audience. And then there's the American audience. We can go back as far as you like, but certainly we could start with the Board of Broadcast Governors, the hearings they had in the Senate. It was last year, I think, or the year before, where they were, you know, chastising Russian propaganda such as RT and such, and saying that we had to do something. And then there was the Russian billionaire that bought, essentially set up a business in partnership with the Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty and all of that with the U.S. intel media. And we have this presidential campaign of Hillary Clinton, which is itself an exercise in propaganda, pushing the same points, only bringing them to mainstream politics.
You know, it's for me, I've written recently about this at theduran.com. Any suggestion of an alternative narrative is considered propaganda. And that is a really sad testament to the public sphere today, is that if you dissent, it must be propaganda. If you dissent, you must be paid. If you dissent, it must mean you're crazy. I mean, this is going back to the McCarthyism that the United States suffered in the 1950s and all the way through the 60s. It didn't go away completely, as a lot of people think. The intimidation that people feel, having to have to conform, it's really frightening because if you and I have different points of view, we're considered some kind of national security threat now. That's not the way it should be. That's a very dangerous sphere for all of us to be living in. I mean, dissent is the most powerful tool of social change and of actually dialogue as well. We need to have a discussion. We need to have a conversation. And what's happening now, the powers that be, and particularly the pliant corporate media, do not want any discussion whatsoever. I explained to some of my Russian friends how Western media works. I said, I'll give you the example. Iran. Iran has been made into America's eternal enemy. Though, by the way, most Iranians have a positive feeling about the United States. That's a topic for another program.
Yeah, right.
But what's really interesting, I said, this is the example I give. I said, in American TV, the question is when we should attack Iran. There's never the question, should we attack Iran? We don't get to that kind of conversation. Right. It's already been decided. Right. And this is this game Western media plays. They have this artificial argument, and they say that there's a lot of give and take and different polemics. No, it's already established what the policy outcome should be. Russia is the enemy. And what you see now is this piling on layer after layer after layer, propagandizing it, and it's getting Western publics used to the enemy. The enemy is out there. It's Vladimir Putin. And what I worry about very much with the Hillary Clinton presidency, is that the Western audiences, particularly Americans, are so softened up to this that she may try some kind of gambit in which a war, some kind of conflict could play out. And I can tell you this, Russia has a modernized military force. It cannot project power very far. It doesn't have that kind of military capacity, but it has the capacity to defend itself. And anyone that wants to pick a fight with Russia will pay dearly for it. And I constantly tell viewers on my program, Crosstalk, that do not cross that line, because when the Russians say they have a red line, they mean it.
You know, first of all, that red line is already conceivably on the other side of the Russian border, because at the border, you already have NATO's troops in a
yep.
long part of the Western border. And then in the east, you have the U.S. military bases all over the place, from Okinawa to South Korea. So, and power being projected by the United States into the South China Sea, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of Russia's ability to project power, though, you know, it may be that they don't have an occupation force that could come, or an invasion force that could come to the United States and, say, occupy New York or Chicago, but they certainly have the ability to destroy them.
Absolutely. One of the tragedies of the post-Cold War period is that Western electorates, societies in general, have forgotten the fear of thermonuclear war. This is tragic because it's there, and Russia will defend itself. For example, when I hear Secretary Kerry and others in the Senate and in the U.S. Congress talk about the fate of Crimea, I say very loudly and clearly, if you agree with me or not, That is Russian soil. And if you do anything, we saw those machinations a few weeks ago with the Kiev government trying to send in infiltrators to sabotage the infrastructure of Crimea. That, from Russia's perspective, that is verging on an act of war. And they will defend Crimea. And that is any kind of threat would be considered an existential threat. But Westerners have no clue about that. And I don't even think the political class is all that clued in. As far as the American military is concerned, well, they want trillions of dollars to upgrade the nuclear deterrent for the United States. They just want to spend more and more and more money. I mean, the establishment and the military-industrial complex work very, very much in hand here. I mean, to be in the military, this is Goldilocks time for them. I mean, the more they talk about Russia as a threat, the more they pad their budgets. And you know what? When you build these types of systems that are threatening to other countries, particularly Russia, Russia will respond. Russia is not initiating an arms race, but it may have to participate in one because of what Washington is doing.
So, looking at the narrative here that's coming out of the two major party campaigns on the question of war with Russia and policy towards Russia, we have Clinton's campaign, which is massaging the idea of Russia as the enemy, massaging the idea of the inevitability of conflict, whether it's political, economic, and or military. And you have Trump saying, wouldn't it be nice if we could be friends with Russia and work together on problems like defeating ISIS? The aftermath in the United States of November 8th, whenever election day is, I believe November 8th, is going to follow one of those two tracks, obviously, beginning on January 20th. And I assume the interim policy of President Obama will, you know, work to either set up or foil that of the coming president, depending on who wins. So what do you see happening, like, in the early part of the year, next year, you know, some of the hot spots that are going on, some of the dangers that we're looking at?
The interesting thing is here, for all of the claptrap and nonsense written in American media about Russia, Russia has contingency plans. I can tell you quite honestly, maybe there are individual figures within the Kremlin that would root for one candidate or another. But the rule of thumb is that it's going to be a hostile person. I mean, you can nitpick all you want in Western media, American media, because you're right. So much of it's about revenues and creating stories to create sensation, to create interest, and to get the eyeballs and the clicks and all of that. Right. But you know, the Russians are very cold and sober about it. They see hostility, they feel hostility all the way up to its borders, and they're going to be prepared for whoever comes in. I think it's common sense that if Trump comes in and he's going to own up to his words, then maybe we can lower the tempo of the temperature of these tensions here, because no one here wants a conflict. Russians are so war adverse. They will prepare for it, but they're not going to start it. So from that perspective, it's just, you know, you have to hope for the best. And that's really what Russia's policy is going to be. What we have to look at, too, is that I'm still convinced that we could see some kind of October surprise in Ukraine.
Yeah,
I think there was a dress rehearsal for that with those infiltrators. I think they wanted to see how it would fly, what would be the reactions. I mean, if you read the Western narrative about what happened there, it's so ridiculous. I mean, I feel like I could sell people the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, are people that gullible?
Yes.
But anyway, I think that, you know, we could see a pressing of Ukraine. I am. Totally skeptical of John Kerry's efforts in Syria. I have this theory that Lavrov explains it all to him, the foreign minister here in Russia. Yeah. I think he explains it all to him, and Kerry kind of nods his head, and then he'll finally decide by the last person he talks to, and that's probably somebody in Washington, D.C. Right. So Lavrov gets him all the way there, holds his hand all the way to see if we can get some kind of ceasefire and start some kind of winding down of the war. And then Kerry just, you know, he jumps off the boat. He just deep six it. And I don't think he does it maliciously. I just don't think he's in control. The Russians repeatedly have put forth really commonsensical ways to wind down this war. It can be wound down. If the United States had any control of its allies, this would be over in a matter of weeks.
Well, I think the possibility certainly exists that they do have control, and that what we're seeing is American policy, however randomly it appears to be constructed.
Well, there's a number of wild cards in there. For example, Turkey, which is a fascinating case study of power politics, because it's very, very unclear to what degree the Americans and the Turks are working together, how much the Turks are going to hoodwink the Russians and the Americans. Erdogan is he's a survivor, but you know that doesn't necessarily make you a winner. And so we'll see how this goes. What I worry about in Syria is that we're getting to see a partition start being played out. I don't see the Turks leaving anytime soon from Syria, which is, at least at first blush, it's not a good idea, because you get used to the idea of the country being partitioned, creating little statelets and whatnot, and that's very unstable. You get them to fight each other. The Israelis would love that scenario, because it will give them hegemony over much of Syria, which they would very much like to have.
Well, it'd be like the Golan Heights, because there was an incident just today or yesterday in the Golan Heights, and when they referred to interaction with Syria, because Israel bombed some part of Syria supposedly in retaliation for an alleged bombing by or shelling by Syria of Golan Heights, and they never mentioned anywhere that it was ever part of Syria.
Absolutely, absolutely
forgotten.
What I think that we will have to look at what's going to happen over the course of this week. I don't have any really strong hopes the ceasefire is going to work. But one of the interesting things, and maybe your listeners can ponder this here, the details of the truce are secret. They're not going to be released. And it seems to me that Washington has made at least a temporary concession, and they said that they would make some kind of concession, but you can't tell the public, because we do know that Assad and his the Syrian army have made considerable advances since the February truce, and so they want to keep their gains. And this is one of the reasons why the Americans are talking to the Russians again, is because, as I have said for years, there is a military solution to the war in Syria. There is a military solution that's defeating terrorists and the proxies that support them. That's how you can end this here. Right. The Americans are waffling, and we're gonna have to kind of hold our breath for the next week or so to see what the secret deal is really all about. Who's going to spill the beans? But I bet you my bottom dollar that Kerry made some kind of concession that he doesn't want the world to know about.
Wow. If we don't end up with President Clinton, but we end up with President Trump, I'm presuming that Russia is certainly not going to change its defensive posture, until there's material change in the conditions between the two countries, including probably the removal of troops from Russia's borders.
Well, you know what? I think you'll like this, and I think our listeners are like this, too. Vladimir Putin's approach to what you just said will probably be quoting Ronald Reagan, trust, but verify.
Yeah.
The level of trust is zero. It's negative after what has been said and done over the last few years. People in the West don't understand how damaging the American escapade, European Union escapade into Ukraine, how it's damaged. And it's a permanent, that country is permanently damaged, and Russia is going to be, I think it's built into its genetic code. I mean, they hear so many promises and nice words coming from Washington and Brussels, but they're never true. And again, as we started our conversation, the people that they hoped to attract to their side inside of Russia, they've turned against these policies as well, the ones that are in the West. And this has solidified Putin's popularity it's almost unheard of in the Western world to have this kind of popularity. And Putin does use it sparingly. Again, I have to tell our listeners is that in Russian politics, Putin is a moderate. He is a moderate force. He's not an extremist. He holds back the liberals. He holds back the nationalists. He very much is down the line in the center. And his priorities are simple. There are two. Is to modernize Russia and to make sure it can defend its sovereignty. That's Vladimir Putin, 16 years in power, in two sentences.
Yeah, I don't think people in the United States understand this part of it, but my understanding, and I haven't been there since it was a USSR, but my understanding is that the conditions that prevail in Russia, economic and social and political conditions, resemble more the kind of socialism that Bernie Sanders would bring to the United States than any right-wing, regime, you know, right-wing neoliberal regime.
It's a very interesting observation, because that's one of the things with my work and the type of people I'm around. They're usually upper middle class people. But I always kind of poke them, because they do embrace the market and a capitalist system. But they really like to hang on to the old socialist communist perks. Like, yep. You don't have to pay for cold water, okay? Right. Nope, it's all free. Yep. And I'm a guy from California. I hate watching people waste water, but it's cold water. You don't have to pay for it. Very cheap natural gas prices, and most homes use natural gas for warmth and for cooking. There's a lot of these little things out there that it's really a hybrid still. You still have the state involved in some very large industries, which I think they should. I don't think they should be in private hands. So in a way there is something to that. Bernie would have succeeded in Russia, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. He just couldn't call himself a socialist, that's all.
Well, that just shows the lack of maturity. You can't use certain words. Isn't that really amazing?
It's ridiculous.
Because, here's a country that I live in now that was a very authoritarian society, and there was intense censorship. You couldn't leave the country. You could face penalties for listening to foreign broadcasts. Middle-class Russians have France 24, Al Jazeera, BBC. It's all on cable. It's 500 channels. Watch whatever you want to watch. There's no control over that whatsoever. You can move in and out of the country. I put on Facebook a few weeks ago a young man at a shopping center full of people, and he was holding a poster criticizing Russia's the return of Crimea to Russia, and he was standing there and he was blaming Putin, and it was a big poster, and everybody just walked by. A few people took a few pictures, and he wasn't harassed. He stood there all day. The police didn't stop him. He goes, "That's your business, dude. That's your poster. You're not bothering anyone. Everyone, that's how it is." People think about politics in Russia in two ways: their standard of living, and when someone speaks bad of Russia and throws shit at it, that's when people start coming together. And I really like that about Russians, because that's when they come together. Other than that, they're not always particularly nice to each other. They're like New Yorkers, it's an elbow society. But when push comes to shove, they really close their ranks. And this is a time of closing ranks. Like I've said over and over again, everything that's said about their country is instantly translated into Russian. They know what the outside world thinks of them. They know what the West does. And they see Putin at G20 in China. And who's the most popular guy? Who had the most meetings on the sidelines? Who was the most important invited guest, the guest of honor?
Who got the red carpet treatment?
Well, I don't know if you saw that video, but when the American officials were arguing with the Chinese, and the Chinese said, "This is our country. This is our country." Again, in a nutshell, one short video says it a lot. Yep. The arrogance of the Washington elite is they're so arrogant, they're not even aware of it. They're not even aware of it. Right. And this is what's really the end of empire, this mentality. I mean, it must have been like the Romans, saying, "But we control the whole world. How can you say differently?" And the Chinese are saying differently now. I thought it was very interesting. On today's Crosstalk, it'll be aired all day Monday, we talk about the optics of the G20, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah. And on that note, Peter, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate
it. It's always a pleasure, my friend.
The same. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.